You go to Memorial Medical Center. Cora stood by the window looking into the observation room, watching Kaiten's chest rise and fall in time with the hissing and clicking of the ventilator, a pensive frown on her face. Turning to the white-coated figure next to her, she said, "You're sure? There's nothing to be done?" Dr. Kuva shook his head. "Nothing, Avatar. He's suffered extensive neurological trauma, both chronic and acute. He'd obviously been abusing the drug we found in his system for some time, and the trace levels he showed when he got here indicated that he took a massive dose of the stuff just before his fight with your friend." He closed the chart he held and shook his head. "That young man will never regain consciousness. In layman's terms, the comet, and the exertions it drove him to commit, burned out his brain. He can't even breathe on his own. By most standards, he's already dead." "Hmm," said Cora, not really in reply. She turned and gazed through the window for a few more seconds, her face glum. "What a waste," she murmured, shaking her head sadly. "What a damned sorry waste of a life. This has to be stopped." "Huh," the doctor replied. "Natural selection in action, if you ask me. One more ashmaker who thought he could be the next Sozin. His kind get what they deserve." Cora rounded on him, her eyes angry and intense. "That's enough, doctor," she snapped. Holding him mesmerized with the fury in her gaze, she raised one arm and pointed to the slumped figure in the bed. "That is a human being in there. A young man in the prime of his life. And maybe he did bring this on himself, but does anyone deserve a fate like that?" she demanded. Then, shaking her head in disgust, she shouldered past him, muttering, "You're supposed to be a physician. Show some respect." "He said, raising a hand, but she stormed off down the hall and through the stairwell door at the end, never looking back. Not until she reached the street had she cooled off enough to speak to anyone. Taking out her gear phone, she pressed a speed dial code and said, "Eitaro, it's Cora. We were wondering what the monsoon's angle was. Well, I think I know." The rest of the conversation took only a few moments. Then, sighing, Cora put away her phone, swung up into Neri's saddle, and said, "Let's go home, girl. Last thing I want tonight's to be alone." They came back together at dinner, those who had ventured into town and those who had gone for experimental jogs, everyone but Nall, who remained curiously absent, and the sisters, who sat at opposite ends of the main table with the rest of the airbenders and paid as little attention to each other as possible. This gave the occasion a slightly frosty undertone for those conscious of the subtext, but no one else seemed to notice. Most were too busy cooing over Annabelle, who, freshly cleaned, fed, and securely affixed to her mother, was making her debut at Cora's table. Caitlin and Anne arrived a little late, the latter a trifle singed. This gave people a new thing to exclaim over, though she turned aside their concerns as gracefully as she could. "I'm fine, it's nothing," she said. "Training accident?" Rory wondered, examining her scorched cheek. As always, he looked decidedly unmedical. A teenage boy in Dockers, sneakers, and an unzipped hoodie, over an old T-shirt emblazoned with an outdated Sirius Cybernetics Corporation slogan, "Your plastic pal who's fun to be with." In spite of his perpetual need of a shave, he was obviously little, if any, older than the girl whose injury he was inspecting. But word of his calm competence in attending Annabelle's birth had spread, and Anne was prepared to take his credentials as a matter of faith. If Anthea and Utrina believed he was a doctor, that was good enough for her. She shook her head. "No," she said. Sifu Izana and I had a little, problem at lunch.
Not with each other, I hope,
Amy put in, a bit startled.
Oh, no, no,
Anne hastened to assure her.
No, we're...
She smiled a little abstractly.
We're great.
No, this was a third party. I probably shouldn't say any more. The police are looking into it. Cora arrived then, striding over to the table with a purposeful frown.
Anne, are you all right?
She asked without preamble.
I'm fine,
Anne repeated, looking both pleased and a bit exasperated at all the attention.
Really, it doesn't even hurt.
I take it you heard? Caitlin inquired. Cora nodded. I just came from the scene, she said. Ataro and I were having lunch with Emily when he got the call. Is what dispatch told him true? The man who attacked you was hopped up on Comet? Anne shrugged slightly.
Well, I'm no expert, she qualified, but he was hopped up on something.
And technically he didn't attack me, he attacked Izana-sensei. She indicated her most visible burn and added ruefully, I got this from falling rubble.
It's not very serious, Rory agreed, but I'd still like to get a little Dermatrex on it after dinner, just to be on the safe side.
I'm not going to argue with that, said Anne. Then, taking a closer look at him, she noticed the jaunty American Civil War head bandage he was sporting, and asked,
What happened to you?
Amy giggled. Girls 21, boys 7, she said. Despite her serious mood, Cora couldn't help but snicker at that.
Nice,
she said, bumping fists with the young Scotswoman. Then she turned her attention back to Anne.
Did you give the investigating officer at the scene a statement? She asked.
Anne nodded. I didn't see most of the actual fight. I was too busy trying to keep the block from burning down.
Well, from what I saw, it looked like you did a pretty good job, said Cora with a distracted smile.
Inspector Imanishi will want to get a more detailed account from you. It's a Comet incident, so his task force is taking over the case.
Aren't you guys leaving tomorrow?
That was the plan, Kate confirmed. We're both supposed to be in New Avalon first thing on Monday. Cora thought that over, then nodded.
I'll see if I can get him to come out and talk to you tonight, then, just to get that loose end tied up before you leave town.
Okay, Anne agreed. Then she smiled crookedly and added, I'm not used to being so comfortable about talking to the police.
Cora chuckled.
Well, Itaro's a sweetheart. You won't have any problems with him. He just wants to make sure the record is as complete as it can be. You're certainly not in any trouble.
Well, that's good to hear, said Anne.
At the far end of the main table, Lakpa ate her dinner as quickly as she could, then excused herself and slipped quietly away. No one seemed interested in her departure. The youngsters were wrapped up in their own matters, the elders as well, and Nima had done an extremely convincing job of acting as though she hadn't noticed her sister was even in the room throughout the meal. She found Nall exactly where she'd left him, exactly where he'd been all day long, on the topmost level of the Air Temple's tower, gazing meditatively out not at the Republic City skyline, but rather at the jagged mountain peaks to the north of the city. He didn't seem to hear her coming up through the trap door, only when she slipped up behind him and put her arms around him, her hands sliding across his chest, did he acknowledge her presence, raising a hand to grip one of her wrists gently.
Hey, he said.
You've been up here all day, Lakpa pointed out, entirely unnecessarily.
Why?
She wondered. What are you looking at over there?
The mountains, Nall told her.
They remind me of...
a lot of things. Draconia and Hyrule. He sighed.
Where your last girlfriend was from, said Lakpa.
Where I lost her, Nal replied.
Lakpa held him a little tighter and asked quietly, Do you wish she was here now?
Not really, said Nal, squeezing her wrist a little in response. Then he added wryly, If she was, and she saw us like this, there'd probably be a god-awful fight.
Lakpa snorted. That's not what I meant.
I know, I was dodging the question, said Nal matter-of-factly. Then, before she could press the matter further, if indeed she planned to, he took a deep, slow breath and said,
I dreamed about Nax last night. He wanted to know if I had enjoyed killing him. If I understood yet that a real dragon would have.
Nal, stop it, said Lakpa. Just stop it. Dragons don't have to be cruel. You should read Avatar Roku's book about his travels with Fang. They were best friends all of their lives.
Wasn't Roku's other best friend Fire Lord Sozin? Nal asked skeptically.
That doesn't really recommend him as a judge of character.
He sighed.
I'm sorry, Lakpa. I know you're trying to help.
He turned around in her arms, so he was facing her, and put his hands on her shoulders.
I'm not very good company today. Maybe you should go hang with the rest of the crew instead. They're heading back in the morning.
Lakpa glanced away.
I don't think that would be such a good idea, she said. Corwin's pretty mad at me right now.
Nal quirked an eyebrow. Why?
She told him about both her prank on Nima the night before and her defensive reaction to Corwin's displeasure with it in the morning.
Oh, said Nal.
He took another deep breath. Yeah, I can see where that would tick him off. Twice, even. Once because you were mean to Nima, and once because you copped an attitude when he called you on it.
I know, Lakpa said, resting her head on his shoulder. It's been nagging at me all day. I didn't want to admit he's right, but he kind of is. I mean, everything I told him was true, but...
She sighed.
It's not Nima's fault she's so damned perfect. She just is. The spirits favor some people. It doesn't do any good to envy them for it.
Nal chuckled wryly. Nima's probably telling herself the same thing about you.
Me?
Lakpa stepped back to regard him quizzically. What in the world would she envy about me? She's smarter, stronger, a better airbender than I'll ever be. Graceful, confident. The one thing I've got that she hasn't is my looks, and Nima doesn't care about appearances.
She knows she shouldn't care about appearances, Nal corrected her. But sometimes we can't help ourselves.
Said Lakpa, as though the possibility had never occurred to her before.
I mean, you know better than to get attached to me, but...
Here we are, Nal went on.
Here we are, Lakpa agreed, and kissed him. At least until tomorrow.
Actually, I think I'll stay, said Nal.
Lakpa looked pleasantly surprised.
Really?
Not right here, he qualified, but in Dicho. Maybe I'll see if I can find a proper dragon peak over there, he added, gesturing to the mountains that were now behind him. Stop pretending to be a man for a while and see where that gets me.
With a sardonic grin, he added, You can come visit when you get your bison license. Venture into my lair and risk your monastic chastity.
Bah, she said, I only dress like a monk. And she kissed him again.
After their own dinner, the rest of the visitors and Cora retired to the parlor of Tenzin's house for a low-key last evening of team togetherness. Those who hadn't made the trip to Mount Weitang oohed and aahed over the photos Corwin and Ryo had taken. All agreed that it was going to be a dynamite place for a vacation home. "The hard part's going to be access to the site," Corwin observed, looking over one of the aerial shots they'd taken upon departing. "We'll either have to build some kind of a road or bring everything in by air. Either option could get complicated." "Well," Cora mused, "a rough construction road is just a matter of a few days to a week with an earthbending team. Anything more refined than that, you'll have to go to the Road Builders Union. And probably the Republic DOT, if you want it to tie into the public roads. The planning office probably has some information on that. You should check with Chin. He'll know who you should be talking to over there." Corwin nodded. "Man," he declared, shaking his head and flipping through a couple more of the images. "Wish I had a couple more weeks, at least, to really get started on this." He looked up from a panorama of the falls and grinned at her. "It's exciting."
"Actually, Cora and I were talking about this last night," said Utena.
"Why don't we?
I mean, we haven't got anything really pressing to rush back to, have we?"
She gestured to her wife, who was giving her an interested look, and went on, "Anthony and I don't have to be back at NIT until the fall semester starts, and you're pretty much completely at liberty, Corwin."
"And that being the case," Cora added, "why don't you guys stay a while longer? Stay right through the summer if you want."
"We can actually build the house," Utena declared. "People can come visit us once their spring semesters and whatnot end. It'll be good times."
She picked up the nearest book and gestured with it. "We are grown-up people with a child and everything, and we can do whatever we darn well want. It says so right here in the handbook."
"That's my copy of Love Amongst the Dragons," Kate pointed out with a little smile.
"Details," Utena replied.
Corwin's grin widened.
"You're not going to get any argument out of me," he said cheerfully.
Then, his brow furrowing, he went on, "Although, no Valiant summer tour this year?" Kate gave him a lovingly indulgent look.
"Did you think I've been planning on one this whole time, knowing there'd be a newborn in the captain's family?" she said, reaching out to ruffle Lutrina's hair.
"That'd be pretty optimistic, even by our standards. We can find something else to do with ourselves for a summer."
"We have got rock and roll in Dicho, you know," Cora pointed out with a grin.
"Alternate reality world tour, anyone?"
Kate laughed.
"I bet the guys would love it. We've never done a proper one-planet world tour, and it's always fun to break in new audiences."
"Oh, man," said Anne. "Do you think Dicho is ready for Ezalin?"
"She's been here before," Caitlin said. "Nobody went to jail, although admittedly it was only the one time."
"Anthy, you haven't had much to say," said Utena. "What do you think?"
Anthy smiled. "I've just been enjoying all your reactions," she said. "I think it's a fine idea. So long as Jinora doesn't mind us staying in her house a while longer, I wouldn't want to overstay our welcome."
"Oh, don't worry about that," Cora assured her. "I ran it by her while you were all up checking out Mount Weitang this morning. She likes you guys. Particularly you, Anthy," she added with a grin. "You'd better watch yourself. If you stay here all summer, she's liable to try and recruit you."
Anthy chuckled.
"It'd be an honor," she said.
With that, the Trinity started discussing the particulars of extending their stay, trying to anticipate anything that might need doing either back in the big universe or in Sephiro in the next few months. Getting back and forth wouldn't be a particular problem, nor would communications,
but it would be important for people to know where to find them if there were issues, and there were a few logistical matters that needed handling. They'd only packed for a few days, for instance. While they were working on sorting all that out, there came a knock at the door, and Cora got up from where she'd been lounging against Neri's side to admit a middle-aged gentleman in a crumpled gray suit and overcoat. "Hey, Taro, come on in," she said, gesturing him inside. "Meet my new team. Everyone, this is Inspector Imanishi. You've heard me talk about him." She introduced him around. Imanishi greeted everyone politely, bowing to all, and then asked if he might have another word with Miss Cross before she left his jurisdiction. "Of course," she said, rising. "Let's go to the front room." Imanishi's manner, once they were settled in armchairs in the front room, was calm, affable, and soothing, putting her immediately at ease. "Let me just assure you again, Miss Cross, you're not in any trouble," he said while he got out his notebook. "Far from it. By Fire Marshal Kaziro's estimate, your actions most likely saved a half dozen buildings, and perhaps three times as many lives today." Anne felt herself blushing slightly. She glanced away, grinning crookedly, and said, "Well, I'm just glad I could help." "You certainly did. There's no doubt about that. And it is a thing you shouldn't hesitate to be proud of. I know that the temptation is always there to assume that no good deed will go unpunished," he added with a small smile, "but we try not to operate that way in Republic City." Opening his notebook, he went on, "Now let's just go over what you saw and heard one more time, and I'll let you get back to your evening." It took Imanishi only about 10 minutes to take a second statement from his witness, since her initial statement had been very comprehensive, and his few follow-up questions were direct and easily answered. At the end, he rose and closed his notebook, saying, "Well, thank you, Miss Cross. I think that's all I need from you. I'm sorry this happened. I hope it won't color your impression of our city too badly." Anne gave her crooked smile again. "I wouldn't worry about that," she said. "Even given this afternoon, I think there's a lot more good than bad in Republic City. Believe me, I've seen so much worse." Imanishi smiled. "I'm pleased to hear it," he said. "Not that you've seen worse, but that you find Republic City agreeable in spite of your experience today." Tucking his notebook away in his coat, he bowed to her. "Have a safe journey home. I understand you're planning to return in the summer?" "That's the plan," Anne confirmed, standing to return his bow with a firebender salute. "Probably in early June. Do you think I'll need to come back before then to testify at the trial? I can if I have to, but I'll need a little advance warning." Imanishi's face was solemn as he shook his head and replied slowly, "I doubt there will be a trial, Miss Cross." Anne looked a bit troubled when she returned alone to the sun parlor, but no one noticed. The mood was dispelled almost instantly, anyway, by the sight that greeted her when she arrived. Neri had shifted her position, sprawling on her side and taking up most of the floor space between the futon daybed and the sofa. Serge had positioned himself alongside the futon, more or less at right angles, so that the two lay almost nose to nose, and both were dozing contentedly while their mistresses brushed them. "Look at all these orange hairs," Cora remarked, scraping her brush. "People are going to talk, girl." "They do make a gene mod that would turn his orange parts white," Kate said cheerfully, "but then you'd still have the black ones to deal with." She looked up and smiled at Anne. "All set?" Anne nodded. "No problems," she said. And at this moment, in this room full of friends and love, she meant it. Saturday, March 20th. The next morning saw a bustle of activity after breakfast, as most of the visitors prepared to leave and just about everyone else got ready to see them off at the station. In the foyer of Tenzin's house, Utena, by now feeling like an old hand, was getting Annabelle prepped for the field while Corwin sorted out the travel kit. They were in a slight hurry, as there was a ferry to catch, but everything appeared to be going smoothly, and there was no cause for concern.
"Where'd Anthy get off to?" Utena wondered, looking around. "We can't wander too far without her, now can we?" she inquired of Annabelle.
At that moment, Anthy appeared on the landing at the top of the stairs overlooking the entryway, dressed for the excursion in her borrowed air acolyte clothes again.
"Corwin, would you come up here for a moment, please?" she asked, smiling. "I need your help with something."
Corwin glanced in faint puzzlement at Utena, who shrugged. There wasn't anything up there as far as either of them knew. They hadn't used any of the upstairs rooms apart from stealing the futon daybed out of one. But neither was inclined to argue, so Corwin said only, "Sure, be right there," then zipped up the bag, put it next to Utena, and trotted up the stairs. By the time he got up there, Anthy had turned and now led the way up the hall into one of the side rooms. More puzzled than ever, Corwin followed her inside. It was the room they'd taken the futon from, and now lacked anything much in the way of furniture.
"He began. But before he could finish the question, she had turned, shut the door, and then backed him up against the inside of it, kissing him with a sudden, unaccustomed ferocity that brought Titan instantly to his mind.
"Oh, hello," he remarked quietly when, at length, she partly relinquished him, her hands still framing the sides of his face.
"Do you remember?" Anthy asked a trifle breathlessly. "When I said, 'This is only for today'?"
"Yes," Corwin replied, arching an eyebrow. Anthy gazed into his eyes for a second, then smiled wryly and said,
"I've changed my mind," before setting back to work.
They nearly missed the ferry, arriving dockside at a run just before the boat was to sail, and received some deeply skeptical looks from some, and deeply amused ones from others, of their party. But no one said a word as they scrambled aboard, and the boat set off for the mainland. The timetables lined up such that they had 10 minutes or so to kill at Central City Station before the Psycho Limited, doing business as the East Bow Psi Limited until the Vale, departed. Azana and Karana arrived at almost the same time as the party from Air Temple Island, and Master Ito as well, and they had a sort of miniature going-away party on the concourse.
"A gift for you, from one peer to another," said Ito.
Bowing, he handed Kate a polished wooden case, like a small and unusually ornate fishing tackle box with a cylindrical scroll case attached to the lid.
"You will have to find a craftsman to make the table for you," he explained, "but everything else you need to continue your study of Pai Sho is there."
Kate smiled and put the box down on top of her suitcase so that she could return his bow properly.
"Thank you, Ito-sensei. I shall treasure it."
"Health and happiness to you, Master Caitlin, until we meet again," said Ito.
Glancing a few yards down the platform to where Azana, just out of earshot, was seeing Anne off, he smiled sentimentally and went on,
"Thank you for allowing your student to enrich my granddaughter's life. I believe that in teaching her, Azana has found something she didn't think she was missing."
"Well, I guess this is goodbye for now, Juniper," said Azana, who seemed none the worse for her adventure the day before.
"Do keep me apprised as your travel plans for the summer solidify. We have a fair number of road games in June, and we'll need to coordinate our timing carefully."
Anne nodded.
I'll do that.
Then, composing herself, she saluted and bowed, saying,
Thank you, Azana-sensei, for agreeing to teach me. I've learned so much in just the first week.
As have I, Azana replied, returning the salute. Then the elder firebender hugged her, adding in a much less formal tone of voice,
Stay safe, Junichan. I hear it's dangerous out in the big universe.
It has its moments, Anne conceded, returning the embrace. But so does this place. You watch out for yourself, too.
Ah, no worries, Karana said, putting a proprietary hand on her bending partner's shoulder with a grin.
With the MLB season starting, she'll be too busy to get any more fights with those assholes from the Agni Kai, and I'll be around to put out any new fires that might start, she added, winking. She hugged the younger girl as well, then trotted off to give her regards to Kate and the Ponds.
One more thing before you go, said Azana.
So saying, she unslung the small black leather valise she was carrying from her shoulder and offered it to Anne, who took it with a puzzled expression.
The books I promised you, Azana explained. There ended up being four, so I thought you would appreciate it if I included something to carry them in, she added, smiling.
Anne examined the bag for a moment. It was a soft briefcase with a top flap, like a messenger bag, and was obviously well-traveled. Embossed on the front of the flap was a seal or crest, bearing Tongyu writing she couldn't read. With a smile, she shouldered it opposite her small duffel bag, then bowed again to her teacher.
Thank you, she said. I'll try to have read them by the time we see each other again.
There won't be a quiz, Azana assured her. Safe travels, Anne. I'll see you in June.
Well, well, look who finally came up for air, said Amy with a grin, a short distance away, as Nal and Lakpa entered the concourse from the street doors and hurried toward them.
As it were, she added playfully.
We were beginning to think you weren't coming with us, Rory put in.
Actually, I'm kind of not, said Nal. But I wanted to see you guys off and thank you for coming. I hope you had a good time.
Are you kidding? Amy asked him. We've had the best time. Thanks so much for inviting us.
You're welcome back any time, Cora told her, then grinned. The Air Kids will be talking about you guys for months.
What do you mean you're kind of not going with them? Corwin wondered.
Can we not talk about this right now? Nal replied. It's complicated. Later.
Okay, said Corwin, drawing it out a trifle skeptically. Then he added, Anyway, you probably hadn't heard. We're staying too. Utena, Anthe, and me. And Annabelle and Garnet, obviously. Building a house up in one of the mountains outside the city. Man, you should have seen the place. Rohan and Iki took us up yesterday. You'd like it. It's all dragony up there.
Nal looked somewhere between pleased and awkward, an anomalous expression indeed for him.
That's great, he said, sounding as if he wasn't quite certain of that. The conductor shouted for all to board the East Bao Sai Limited. With final hugs, kisses, handshakes, and whatever else was warranted, the party separated into two, one boarding the train, the other standing back to watch it depart. As it pulled smoothly away, Rory leaned out a window to call a last bit of medical advice to Anthe, but his message was damaged somewhat by the Republic City Railway Authority's safety regulations.
If she starts to... Don't worry, it's perfectly normal.
I'm always going to wonder now, Utena observed matter-of-factly in the quiet that settled once the train was gone.
Neri watched the train disappear around the bend just beyond the switchyard with a downcast expression, then sat down,
raised her nose to the glass and steel latticework above, and uttered a mournful howl. Cora blinked in surprise, looking around, as people paused in their comings and goings to stare in alarm.
"Oh, stop that howling, you big baby," she chided the polar bear dog, reaching up to rub her head. "You'll see him again in the summertime."
She glanced around again, noting the reactions of passers-by, then tugged at Neri's collar and muttered,
"Seriously, Neri, stop it. You're scaring people's children."
Neri subsided grudgingly, rose to her feet, and trudged with Cora and the others, most of them trying, and largely failing, not to laugh, toward the exit.
"Was that your old school bag you just gave the kid?" Karana asked Azana, near the back of the group, as they left the station.
"Hmm?" Azana replied, as if she hadn't quite heard. Then,
"Yes, I suppose it was."
Karana rolled her eyes and addressed her next remark to the fire ferret on her shoulder.
"Oh, listen to her, Pabu. Yes, I suppose it was," she says, like she hadn't really noticed.
"Well, what?" said Azana. "I could hardly expect her to carry 4 hardcover books back to New Avalon by hand. It's a book bag. That's what it's for."
Karana nodded.
"Mm-hmm." Azana glanced narrowly at her friend.
"Karana?"
"I didn't say nothing," Karana protested, spreading her hands innocently.
"Say," said Utina to Corwin, as they emerged from the station. "While we're here, we should go show Kemba your handiwork."
Corwin smiled. "Indeed we should," he agreed. Kemba welcomed them back to her handicrafts stall in the Railway Square Market like old friends. Once she'd received her hug, Utina touched the necklace Corwin had given her and said with a grin,
"I just wanted to come by and show you. He's done the decent thing at last."
The middle-aged water tribeswoman's eyes widened.
"Ooh, that's some nice work," she declared, then elbowed Utina with a sly smile and added, "He is good with his hands."
Then, as the rest of the group that had come with them laughed, Kemba looked them over, noticed Anthy, took a close look at Annabelle, and then turned a judicious eye to Corwin.
Uh-oh, thought Utina.
She had been wondering how long it would be before something like this happened. She, Corwin, and Anthy had never been ashamed of their unusual relationship, nor shy about it. They had accepted that it would occasionally dismay people as part of the cost of doing business. Generally speaking, they didn't care if it did, taking such dismay as evidence that the people who were dismayed were people whose opinions they didn't need to value in the first place. Still, it wasn't as though they customarily set out to flaunt it, to throw it in people's faces, and it was always a little awkward and a little painful when someone they liked turned out to be on that list. It was disappointing. Kemba, though, didn't disappoint them after all. After eyeing Corwin for a moment, she grinned and made a sweeping gesture that took in his whole family.
"You must be quite a hunter, handsome, to be worthy of these 3 ladies," she said cheerfully, firing a wink over Anthea's shoulder at Cora, who quirked a smile in return.
Turning to Anthea, she went on, "He hasn't made a necklace for you, either. And here you've borne him such a fine daughter, too." She whacked Corwin theatrically on the shoulder and declared,
"Hopeless!"
Then, ignoring him, she addressed herself directly to Annabelle, leaning toward her with a smile and saying,
"Hello! How old are you, sweetheart?"
They sorted through introductions, at which point Utina Riley pointed out that if anyone should be getting a hard time for failing to make Anthea a necklace, it was herself, not Corwin. After chatting with Kemba for a while longer, the group began to break up. Azana and Karana had practice to get to, and said their cheerful farewells with promises to be in touch. Utina noticed as they were leaving that Karana, too, was wearing what appeared to be a betrothal necklace, and wondered as to its provenance. She made a mental note to ask Corwin if he knew. Master Ito, too, parted from them at that point, catching a streetcar in the direction of his academy. "She took that awfully well," Utina observed as the somewhat reduced company made their way back toward the ferry quay. "I was worried for a second that we might be in for a disappointment." "Nah, Kemba's seen it all," said Cora with a grin. "Besides, deals like yours aren't completely unheard of in the South Pole. Not common, by any means, but most people know someone who knows someone, and so forth." She nudged Utina with an elbow. "That was what she meant when she said he must be a good hunter," she explained with a wink. "In the old days, that was the only way anybody could support more than one spouse." Hours later, as afternoon drew in toward evening, the East Bao Sai Limited made steadily for Ba Sing Se. In the compartment she shared with Kate, Anne lay in the upper of the two bunks a conductor had appeared to conjure magically out of the bulkhead, and unpacked the bag Azana had given her. There were, as promised, four books inside, all hardcovers, three bound in leather and one in the kind of old-fashioned cloth binding Anne always associated with antique schoolbooks. She opened that one first, and found stamped on its front flyleaf the same seal that was embossed on the book bag's flap. Below it, someone had written a short message in an angular script. "Sensei?" she said. "Yes?" Caitlin's voice replied from the lower bunk. "You can read Japanese, right?" Anne asked. After a short pause, Kate's head and shoulders appeared next to the upper bunk. "Mm-hmm," she said. "The book itself is in standard," said Anne, turning it so Kate could see it. "But I think this note is Kokugo." Kate's eyes scanned the flyleaf. Then she smiled and said, "Heh, so it is." "What does it say?" asked Anne. "This is Azana's book," Kate translated. "Form 4, Autumn Term, 280 ASC. The stamp above it is the school seal. Piandao Academy, Shujing." Anne blinked and turned the book back to look at the note again. "Huh. Azana's from Shujing. I remember her mentioning it. This must have been one of her school books." Kate read the spine and laughed again. "Ah, Love in the Time of Space Sword," she said. "A classic. It would be a natural choice for a standard language class. They would have read it in the original Tongyu in a previous year." "Hmm." Anne investigated the other volumes. "These are all by the same author. Where have I heard his name before?" "Sokka? He was also an artist. You saw one of his drawings at the museum." "Oh, the cartoon of Aang! Maybe I'll find out in one of these what the punchline meant," said Anne with a smile. Examining the books further, she giggled. "He had a flair for titles, too. Crazy from the Heat, The Adventures of Snow Savage and Dirt Girl, To Wang Fire, Thanks for Everything, Tai Li." Kate chuckled and returned to her bunk. "Sokka was one of his generation's great wits," she said dryly. After a bit more investigation, Anne put away the other books, rearranged her pillows a bit more comfortably, and settled in for the long haul with Love in the Time of Space Sword. As she opened it, an item fell out from between two of the pages, landing softly on her chest. Closing the book again on her finger, she picked it up and turned it over. It was a color photograph of two girls in their early teens, one pale and raven-haired, the other all in shades of brown, both dressed in natty black and red uniforms with pleated skirts over tights, golden sashes at their slim waists, shoes with slightly upturned pointed toes, and a familiar structure to the shoulders of their single-breasted jackets. School uniforms, as seen through the fashion sensibilities of the Fire Nation. With a mild shock, Anne realized that they were Azana and Karana in their early teens, maybe 9 or 10 years ago. Karana, grinning broadly, had one arm hooked around Azana's neck and was making a V-sign for the camera with the other hand. Her jacket was open and the shirt beneath it undone to the third button, showing just the top edge of what Anne recognized as a sports bra. And she was wearing what looked like the same stylish little choker-style necklace Anne had noticed on her as an adult. Azana, somehow unsurprisingly, fully buttoned up, was glancing at Karana. She looked slightly startled, but there was a little smile playing at her lips. Anne's face wore a similar expression as she regarded the picture. It appeared Azana hadn't been expecting to get glomped like that when whoever had taken the picture produced the camera, but apart from having been startled, she didn't seem to mind. "I had no idea they'd known each other that long," she thought. She guessed the photo had been used as a bookmark, then forgotten, and wondered if Azana might want it back. She'd have to check. Looking at it again, she rather hoped not. She'd like to keep it, if she could do so without coming across as all weird about it. She liked Azana too much, and valued their working relationship too highly, to want to risk that. Anne tucked the photo into the back of the book and sighed, turning to the first page of the introduction. "Don't overthink it," she told herself sternly, and began to read. Back on Air Temple Island, Korra's table felt a little empty at dinner, with most of the party gone. But Nima was back, her equanimity repaired by a night's sleep and a day's meditation, and they were a cheerful, if diminished, group as they ate and planned the next few days. After eating, when the Air Acolyte stewards cleared away the dishes, they set to working out which of their things they would need to retrieve from New Avalon in the next few days, and how they would arrange that. Corwin's parents wanted to visit anyway, in order to see their first, jointly and separately, grandchild, now that she wasn't being brought back to the big universe any time soon. Both he and Utrina confidently expected that they could be counted upon to bring most of the stuff that was wanted if they were provided with a proper list. Compiling that took an hour or so, after which, with the dining hall otherwise deserted and the staff lingering in the mode of restaurant personnel who want the last customers to leave so they can get on with cleaning up, they adjourned once more to Tenzin's sun parlor to continue plotting. "This is perfect," Korra declared. She stood at the side of the room that faced east, hands on hips, considering the windows and skylights. Dark with evening now, but holding their promise of abundant sunshine during the lengthening days of spring. "I'll move my old drafting table from college in here tomorrow," she went on, turning a grin to Corwin. "Couple of stools, some lamps, a desk for the paperwork, everything we need to set up our own little design office." "Hey, nice," Corwin agreed. "With the mountains right over there for inspiration, and the doors open so we won't go into mole mode." "Yeah, exactly. People can come hang out. We'll take it easy. Work at a nice steady pace. Not get all hyper-focused about it." On the futon daybed, Anthy turned a little smile to Utrina, who rolled her eyes cheerfully. "Yeah, I see that happening," Utrina murmured, but Anthy only giggled softly and gestured toward the pair with her eyes. "It should have a tower," Corwin was saying, using the sketchpad app on his Omnitool to draw a rough, glowing outline in the air. "I was thinking maybe more of a longhouse effect," Korra replied, reaching into the hollow field to draw another shape with her own fingertip. "With a tower," Corwin agreed, adding a child's cartoon tower to one end of it. And so on into the night. Aerie Productions Unlimited and Magnetic Terrapin Studios presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect,
The Legacy of Korra, and The Order of the Rose, Suite for Avatar and Trinity, the Dicho Suite. Third movement, Goodbye and Hello as Always, the Director's Cut. The Dicho Suite will continue in the fourth movement, Familiar Spirits.